Assalamu alaikum, everyone. My name is Muhi Khwaja with American Muslim Community Foundation. And today on the Muslim Philanthropy Podcast, we are so happy to have on Salima Abdul-Ghafoor, who is the Director and Chief of Staff at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Welcome to the show, Salima.
Thank you.
Of course. You know, it's really great to have an opportunity to chat with you. And just really learn from your story, your career, your personal life. So if you can share a little bit more about your background, you can get into where you grew up, where you live, went to school, all of that stuff.
I was born and raised in New Jersey. I am Hassan and Nabila Abdul-Ghafoor's daughter, eldest daughter. Only daughter, and I grew up in their household in a fairly diverse Muslim community in the 80s and 90s. It was the New York City metro area, so we were fortunate that we had lots of different types of cultures and people and religions and experiences. And, you know, I am firmly rooted in the Black American Muslim experience. I was exposed to many other communities. You know, I was a member of the Guyanese Muslim community. I went to summer school with the Egyptians. It was just quite a mix. I ended up going to school in New York at Columbia when I went to college. And now I live in Atlanta.
Great. And what was it at NYU that you studied?
So I was at Columbia, not NYU.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. I went to the MSA.
I'm starting my day. Oh, my Lord.
The NYU MSA is much more active. And.
But we're here to talk about Columbia. My bad.
Egalitarian than the Columbia one was. I went to like one or two Muslim events at the Columbia MSA, and I was like, this is not my tribe, so I'll move on. But Columbia was a good experience for me. You know, it's an Ivy League university. I studied history and urban planning, but got to experience quite a lot by taking courses at SIPA, which is the School of International and Public Affairs, and also at Barnard, which is the women's college that is affiliated with Columbia University. And, you know, again, had sort of the top Western educational experience, but in a very diverse setting and in New York City. So, you know, I started attending a tariqa on Friday evenings and got to experience deepened relationships with the Muslims in Harlem, who have been there for generations, and great relationships with Muslims in Brooklyn and Long Island and Queens. So it was all, even though that it was an isolating experience in some ways because I commuted as opposed to staying on campus when I first went to Columbia, and the Muslim community on the campus was very disparate and not really welcoming. I grounded with my college classmates and actually had a great experience.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that and actually calling out, you know, the problematic truth of that Black Muslim experience, especially in the college MSAs. I think there's definitely a lot of that has improved, but I think there's still some way to go that's been highlighted definitely over the last decade and continues to be. But, you know, I think for the college experience, I'm glad that you were able to also find your own kind of group and people to share that experience and even the Friday night circles and everything like that. So from Columbia and being, you know, involved in the international school and the women's college and everything after that, where did your career kind of lead you?
So I thought I was going to law school to be a lawyer, and I interned at a firm on Wall Street, and I was like, I don't want any part of this. and I was really glad that I found out then before I paid for law school. And, you know, in addition to being firmly rooted in the Black Muslim experience in America, I also was very active, very socially conscious. And my family, you know, really, I got that from my parents. They were socially active. They are very generous in giving and outspoken in terms of civil and human rights. So it was around that time that I started saying, you know, I really want to use the talents and skills that I have and learn new skills and talents. And when I sort of gave up what it should look like and what path I should be on because somebody else said I should, or because, you know, I read it in the book or in the paper and just followed my interests, it worked out tremendously well. So I worked at that law firm for several years, didn't go to law school, but then got recruited to a private foundation in New Jersey, Victoria Foundation, which was basically the Chubb family. It's the insurance family's private foundation, but a significant giver in New Jersey, an open space and economic development, et cetera. And I started to work with Aziza Magazine, which was American right. Muslims, the magazine for American Muslims founded by Taiba Taylor. And that was amazing. That's actually what got me to come to Atlanta, because I left.
Nice.
I left the foundation to come and work for Aziza Magazine for a while, did that and really enjoyed it, had the opportunity to do a book, and did a book called Living Islam Out Loud, American Muslim Women Speak, which was really an anthology of American Muslim women. I wanted to do a book on second generation Muslims, particularly second generation Muslim women, that wasn't through the lens of the immigrant experience or the conversion experience, but women like me who were born and raised Muslim in this country and our experiences, not so much our education and all that stuff, but more so our humanity, our triumphs, our tragedies, the things that connect us to the global human experience. So I did that. And then I got very interested in project management work and international development, and was recruited to launch a project with African heads of state to work on the women and children's health goals. And so we launched that in 2009. And I was actually a Gates grantee at that role. That's how I got on the radar of Gates Foundation. And you know, Gates Foundation sent me the job description. And I said, wow, this is an amazing opportunity to contribute to this industry leader, really, on global development, international global development, particularly on health. So that's sort of the short version of the last 20 years.
I appreciate you sharing that. So, you know, obviously, the Gates Foundation is like a worldwide, globally recognized name. And if you can just share what some of the programs and services are, and then go into a little bit more on like what a day in the life of Salima is.
So our goal, you know, we are also a family foundation started by Bill and Melinda Gates, who are our founders and co-chairs. And Warren Buffett has come along and joined the board as well as a trustee. And essentially, the Gates Foundation is leveraging all of its resources, financial and human, into improving the lives of others, particularly around inequity and particularly around health and global development. So we have significant multi-billion dollar investments in the global south as well as the north, more focused on the global south, sub-Saharan Africa, Southeast Asia, and then significant investments here in the US aimed at dealing with inequity, and particularly inequity around health access. So making sure that women and children have the access to high quality healthcare. You know that, or maybe you don't know, but maternal mortality is on the rise and die childbirth or just after childbirth, and oftentimes their infants die too or are very sick. Maternal mortality is on the rise here in the U.S., particularly among African American women, and particularly in the state of Georgia, but it's also on the rise in many parts of the world, especially in the global south. So we do a lot to fund grassroots organizations, to fund research, to fund projects that give people access to high quality, equal, unfettered access to high quality healthcare. Because when you're healthy, we know that you can show up. You can show up to school, you can go to the farms, you can go to the factory, you can go to your office. And the first thing is you need to be well, you need to be whole mm-hmm. and in good health. More recently, we've done quite a lot to support the efforts around the COVID-19 global pandemic, particularly equitable access to the COVID-19 vaccines. So right now, there's been this rush to market with three now qualified vaccines. 75% of the people who have gotten those vaccines have been in basically 10 of the world's wealthiest countries. So we know that there are several hundred countries in the world. It does not serve us to only have the vaccine be distributed in a handful of countries, right? We know that what happens here will happen there, what happens there will happen here. And so it serves us all to make sure that everyone has access to COVID-19 therapeutics and treatments, but also to the vaccine. We also know that in this country, while access has ramped up, in communities of color, it really hasn't ramped up, that there's still a real disparity in terms of the number of white people who can actually get the vaccine and then the number of people of color who can get the vaccine. So there are real issues of access and equity in local, national, and global health and development. And so we do a lot of work on that. We also do a lot of work on amplifying expert voices at country level. So not just Melinda and Bill's voices, but also doctors and activists who are working in country on these issues. And our co-chairs have a variety of additional ways that they've leveraged their influence. For example, the Giving Pledge, where they've gotten other wealthy individuals, literally triple mm-hmm. digits, to commit to spending down their wealth in the cause of service as well. So I consider it an honor to be working there and to be contributing, and am grateful for the opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, number one, just like being recruited for that role, right? Like, how awesome is that? So congratulations on that level. And it's so great to see, you on the team, and tell us a little bit more about your role as chief of staff and kind of your day to day.
So I'm the director and chief of staff in the communications division, which essentially is a best in class communication division that does all of the work around internal and external communication. So on the internal side, it's with our employees globally, making sure that that we have the tools, the resources, the data to develop best-in-class messaging that will go externally. There's a community of practice of chiefs of staff who work very closely together across the foundation to fulfill the work. Every day is fairly different. We're still struggling to not be in meetings back-to-back and to really give ourselves free and open thinking space, but leadership is committed to making sure that, you know, we have an environment that's, particularly in the work from home environment, where so many of us are also caretakers at home and have all sorts of new pressures and new dynamics created by the work from home environment. But I would say that right now, one of the benefits of being in Atlanta is that I'm 3 hours ahead, so my day starts later. It can also go later, but we start meetings around 7 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, which is about 10 a.m. my time, and can go from 6 or 7 in the evening. I've learned to start blocking my schedule because I actually need space in between to, you know, go to the bathroom, pray, meditate, eat.
Yeah.
I've always been someone where I can't just create a strategy document. We're heavy into OD right now because the division mm-hmm. is stood up. So I actually need blocks of time, 2 or 3 hours, where I can just think and process and research and then integrate it all and then present it in a way that my team and colleagues across the foundation can take it up. So every day does look different, but lots of internal meetings now to make sure that people have what they need. I do a lot of problem solving as chief of staff and director. I do a lot of listening to people's concerns. And I know that's partly because we have so many openings in our division right now. So I expect that to settle down. I do a lot on strategy development because we're in this inflection point where we're looking at our reputation globally and sort of mapping that reputation and making sure that the altruistic values that really ground this work that had our co-chair start the foundation are actually articulated and expressed in a proactive way, both internally and externally. So every day is a little different, but what is consistent is lots of Microsoft team calls, because for safety reasons, none of us are foundation-wide are meeting in right now.
Right, right. Wow, definitely a lot to manage for such a large global entity. And you had talked about the Giving Pledge, and I'm glad you brought that up. You talked about just disparities all across the world, even here in the United States. And when it comes to philanthropy and charitable giving, is there a role and a responsibility for the Giving Pledge or the Gates Foundation, in your opinion, to be supporting more marginalized and minority communities?
Yeah, we can always do more and do better. I think I know the data show that we definitely have been an industry leader. We have gone into all sorts of countries and communities and worked very hard to develop equitable relationship with local country partners. And a big part of our work is sustainability. So not coming as the big, behemoth outside and then, helicoptering in and, throwing around money and then leaving. Our work is actually very collaborative, partnership driven. We can bring great resources, financial, but also human. Technical support, technical assistance is very important. We work very closely with governments, which sometimes gets us into trouble, but we feel that in order to be effective, we have to have good government partners that we work with so that our work can be taken up and so that people can have access. But there's always more that we can do internally and externally to make sure that there's equity internally, to make sure that there's equity externally, to make sure that we're working with partners who can actually scale impact and who can help us to achieve our mission of ending inequality and ending global poverty. I would say that, we are ambitious. We are ambitious optimists and hope for a day soon where we don't have these intractable issues anymore. But there's always more that we can do, even though we are doing a great deal.
Yeah, and I was personally grateful for the foundation's sponsorship of our annual symposium in 2020. So that was a really great way to see that the Gates Foundation is supporting a wide range of causes. And I've also seen the Gates Foundation support efforts to promote giving circles and philanthropy in general. What's the hope there in terms of just showcasing the impact of collective giving and just promoting this sense of community giving to community? Can you share a little bit more on the focus on philanthropy?
We know we can't do it alone, right? The Bill and Melinda could certainly just, be off on a yacht, enjoying their lives somewhere, but they've given, their lives to this work, right? And they know that in order to achieve this world where inequality doesn't exist, where poverty doesn't exist, where children don't die of pneumonia or malaria or polio, where women can give birth in safe ways, where you know, men can farm and have a crop to feed their families, where children can go to school every day. In order to do that, you have to have partners. They cannot do it alone. So it's really, enlightened self-interest. If we want to meet our goals, we know that we have to partner broad and wide. We know that we have to leverage other individuals' resources and talent and ideas and work. We are by no means the only ones in this space, and by no means can we achieve the goals that we want to achieve by ourselves. So we partner far and wide in this country and abroad at government level, civil society level, faith leaders is an area that we know we can deepen our practice. In many of the countries where we have significant investments, we know that we cannot move, say, an issue like family planning, where women have access to birth control and women have knowledge of spacing children or understand what to do if a baby has a fever. We can advance that work if faith leaders don't endorse it and support it, and we're not partnering with them. So we're doing a lot, but we know we have more to do as well.
Yeah, there's a tall order ahead, and there's also so much that the foundation has done. So, you know, it's quite remarkable to kind of see the track record and just the impact that this vision has helped create. And I would say they're very fortunate to have you on their team to help lead with that as well. So, you know, I wanted to ask you personally as well, in terms of your own zakat and sadaqah, what are a few charities that you like to support?
Oh, yeah. So zakat and charity for me, you know, my first teachers were Umi and Abu, my parents, always generous, always with a kind word, always with a smile, always with support. And we were not wealthy. We are not wealthy people. My parents were both teachers, working class. And, you know, my father always tipped the bellboy, the bus driver, the waiter. And so I grew up with a consciousness of generosity. And even now, you know, I remember, you know, years in the past where if I thought I was getting low on money, I would like give money away because it would help to transform and remind me of my blessings. And so I'm really grateful because I've been involved with several really amazing projects. So my top three that I'm giving to now and have given to for quite some time is one, the Georgia Muslim Voter Project, which is here in Georgia and is focused on engaging Georgia Muslims in that voter registration and then getting out the vote. They have been a real change maker in terms of engaging American Muslims in what's happening here in Georgia around voter suppression and efforts to limit our right to vote. In fact, we were a lead plaintiff in one of the voter suppression cases in 2018 and went to federal court and we won that case. So I'm incredibly honored to have been, I'm the immediate past chair of the board, incredibly honored to have been a part of that. And I continue to support it with my time and with my resources. So that's one, the Georgia Muslim Voter Project. It's also one of the few Muslim spaces that I've been that is truly reflects the diversity of the American Muslim community. On our board and our staff, we have, I think it's actually mostly women. I was going to say gender parity, but no, we are mostly women. But we also have a range, ideological range. We have Ismaili Muslims, we have Sunni Muslims, we have Muslims from the African American experience, Muslim from the immigrant experience. We have people who do not define themselves as Muslim. And so we really have focused on the mission and on being a best in practice nonprofit. And that has been our success, as opposed to being narrowly defined in a particular way around Islam or Muslims. So I'm incredibly proud of that work. And now more than ever, we have to keep that work up.
Yeah. And Georgia's role in, you know, getting us back to a blue...
Georgia Muslim Voter Project is nonpartisan. Right. But I personally, Salima, am partisan. And I was so happy to be here at this historic moment when, you know, because of our efforts and the efforts of so many other Black women and Asians, I mean, the Asian American population in Georgia tripled their participation in the election. And I mean,
that's huge.
It is arguably Biden got elected because of Georgia, and the Senate, we know for a fact, is blue because of Georgia. So I've been just so pleased to be able to say that I was a part of this work and that I supported this work at this historic time. And, you know, now is not the time to let up. This, you know, we can see from this massive backlash where they're trying to chip away again at voting rights for people here and around the country that this work is continues to have great need. So, so that's the first one. The second one is Sapelo Square, which Sapelo is a small island off of the coast of Georgia, and is one of these sort of crossroads and intersections where enslaved Africans came and lived and left their traditions. Many of the enslaved Africans were Muslim, and you can still see the result of their history today. Sapelo Square was started by an amazing woman named Dr. Suad Abdul Kabir. And it really is the only repository for African-American Muslim experiences in the country. It's online, and essentially it's a scholarly source for all things African-American Muslims, all experiences, all iterations. And because it is led by a group of phenomenal women, there are men too, but mostly women, they do a lot around the intersection of race and gender, and also Islam. And it's the only place that we have as African-American Muslims to go to witness, refine, and document our culture and our input and our expression of Islam in this world. So Sapelo Square is one that is an online resource, but rich data, writings, and just so proud to know Suad. I mean, she's her website is Dr. Suad, and she's a scholar activist. She's a PhD from Princeton and just has been incredibly active at a global level, an incredible voice for the Muslim community here. So that's the second one that I do a lot of work on. And the third one is one that's also special to my heart. It's called the Muslim Wellness Foundation. It's run by a woman named Dr. Camila Rashad. And one of the things that I think we have, to our own detriment, ignored is the need of mental and emotional health for Muslims, Muslims worldwide, but in particularly in this country. And she's really the only one that I see at an institutional level who is working on mental and emotional health support for Muslims in America, giving permission for us to get this work, but also bringing real rigor, academia, and with a research focus, real rigor. Camila brings to this work. And, you know, obviously, you know, she's got this relatively small organization and the need is so great. But I have attended her lectures. I mean, she's done imam roundtables where imams get to sit down and get together and they give them a case study and then they each have to discuss how they would counsel the person. And there's an audience there that challenges the way they're thinking about it, the guidance that they give. They give tremendous resources and toolkits on what's happening right now, an election toolkit that was actually a joint product of Sapelo Square and Muslim Wellness Foundation. But she's just been incredible. And I am so grateful to have her in my space and so grateful to tell other people about it, because oftentimes I think Muslims are a bit behind when we think about mental and emotional health, and we think we can just, you know, pray away that depression or that anxiety. And prayer is always out front, and you need trained, qualified folks who understand your way of life to help as well.
Right on. You know, for Black History Month, American Muslim Community Foundation highlighted several organizations, and I'm happy to say that Sapelo Square and Muslim Wellness Foundation were both on that list of charities. So we always love boosting fantastic projects, whether it's Black History Month, Women's History Month, Hispanic Heritage Month, and we try to partner
Just
with.
roll right into we're in Women's History Month, and all three of the organizations I gave you are run by women.
Women-led, for sure.
So you can just roll right into March with them.
And the one thing I want to say about Sapelo Square, like, they had a fantastically curated Black History Month exposition.
Oh, yes.
That was curated online. I'm pretty sure it was with the National Museum of African American History and Culture at the Smithsonian. So really fantastic just to see different items of people who were Black Muslim figures. And like, I learned so much. So that in and of
they are
itself.
Like this treasure that so many Muslims don't know about. And,
yeah.
And it's interesting because people who aren't Muslim will tell me, do you know her? I'm like, yes.
That's my girl.
We grew up together, and it's just
for sure.
It's amazing. I've seen some of the stuff, tape recorders that Malcolm X used.
Yeah, yeah.
Every day they're sharing something new. It's been fun. That's the thing, right? Like it's scholarly, but it's also really engaging and fun and interesting to see these you know physical manifestations of our history in this country, particularly when we've been erased and ignored in so much of it, even by people in our own community. So it's a huge win. I mean, we have such pride in seeing Sapelo Square at the Smithsonian and to see the daily curations.
And the last thing I'll say on that as well is like, you know, I've been taking classes at Indiana University on philanthropy and Islam, and they mention Sapelo Island, and they mention how the slaves there would be giving out soraka cakes in tradition of sadaqah because that was the way that they could give to other people. So it's really fascinating to see the deep and enriched history of Islam in America. And it's those stories that bring me pride when I think of all of the leaders that we've had in this country and that I look up to. So, you know, I get to add you on that list. So thank you so much for being part of this discussion. Is there anything else that you'd like to share with our listeners?
No, it's my pleasure, and I'm grateful to you for the opportunity, and thank you to your listening audience for giving me the opportunity to share my work with you. And you know, I encourage you to look up any of those organizations that we just talked about, because you know certainly I'm you know not giving it full due diligence, but I'm really honored to be in this forum.
Yeah, for sure. And everybody can find those organizations in AMCF's nonprofit directory online. The one thing I also want to mention is we're launching and have launched the American Muslim Women's Giving Circle. And we're also working to launch an interfaith giving circle confronting hate. So for those that are interested in those opportunities, you can learn more on the Giving Circle section of our website. For the Gates Foundation, obviously you can find them at gatesfoundation.org, and their Twitter handle is Gates Foundation. Salima, it's been a great pleasure. I'm looking forward to continuing to learn from you and just be with you on this journey in philanthropy. So thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you so much. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.